We are going to start today answering a couple questions that came up last week. They will just take a second. One of them was at the end of chapter 19 in 1 Samuel, we had a whole bunch of people prophesying when even Saul, when he came to take David. And Saul should have seen that that was something that was given to him by God and not pursued David, but he wasn't going to do that. And the question is, what is that prophecy? What does it mean? And I looked up the Hebrew word. It's called Naba, N-A-B-A, if you put it into the English equivalent. It means to speak or to sing by inspiration. And it actually can be a prediction, which a lot of times that's what we think of when we think of prophecy. Or it can also mean a simple discourse, to speak out and to tell some truth. And that's what it was here. You know, Saul wasn't prophesying, predicting something that was going to happen. He was speaking by inspiration, a simple discourse. So we don't know what any of those discourses were, but that's what that was. The other question was the spirit that came upon Saul, this evil spirit from the Lord that we saw in 1 Samuel 16. And I had a couple things down. I printed off some pages, and when I couldn't print off the class attendance sheet, I got all out of sorts and left them sitting there on my desk. But basically, what Matthew Henry and some other people said, it's not that God used the demon and told the, instructed the demon to go, the evil spirit to go on Saul, but he allowed it to happen. This would be similar to what God allowed happen to Job. God allowed the demon to go in there. And so it is Saul, by his choice of rejecting God, and totally rejecting God, it allowed that opening, and God would have permitted Satan or the demon to go in and to attack Saul like he did. So it's more of an allowance of God to do that because of Saul's rejection, rather than God telling the demon and forcing the demon to do what he was going to do, or the evil spirit, or the disturbing spirit. It's translated a couple different ways. So that's quick answers to that question. Let's go to Psalm 3. Yes?
Similar to when Jesus said to Peter that Satan was trying to sift him, right?
In a sense, maybe. But, because Satan attacked, we don't know all of the attacks of Satan and the demons and all that stuff. I mean, we're not told a lot about that, but Jesus did say that to Peter when he said, "Get behind me, Satan." You know, it wasn't that the demon was controlling Satan.
Part where Jesus said Satan is trying to sift you.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And he was not allowed to do that.
Yes. Yes, Jesus kept Satan from sifting Paul, yeah, or Peter. Let's turn to Psalm 3. We're going to hit Psalm 3 today, and then if time permits, we're going to go into 1 Samuel 20. Psalm 3 is 8 verses long, and it's a psalm of David, and it's a psalm that David wrote as he was fleeing from Absalom, his son. Now, we haven't got to that part of David's life yet. We will, but that's a few chapters in the future from where we are now. It reads this: O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God, Selah. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill, Selah. I lay down and I slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek and you break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing on your people, Selah. Now this psalm was written to be sung with a musical accompaniment. Now the story of Absalom is found in 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel 13 through 2 Samuel 18. So we're not going to go through all that today. We're going to get to it. And like I said, this psalm was written by David when he fled from Absalom, who fought against David and his army. Absalom proclaimed himself king of Israel in an attempt to overthrow his father. Now, turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 3, and we're going to kind of see where Absalom got started. 1 Chronicles chapter 3. This is one of those passages that you go, you read it, and it, all it is names and stuff like that, but it does have a connection. Now, these were the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron. The firstborn was Amnon. And you go on, and verse 2, the third was Absalom by the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And then he goes on to all these other sons and stuff. Now, who was this Talmai? Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 27. First Samuel chapter 27, verse 8. Now David and his men went up and raided the Jezreelites and the Girzites and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land of ancient times, as you come from Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. And David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, the clothing, and returned and came to Achish. What did he raid? The Jezreelites. Talmai was the king of the Jezreelites. So somewhere in here, David married his daughter. And then he had this son called Absalom. So Absalom, basically, we find out, will choose his mother's family over his father's family. And he rose up against David. Now, you got to ask yourself, what in the world was David doing? He wasn't being very smart. He was not following God's commands, which told the kings, do not make multiple wives among you. He was disobeying God. And this is going to play out in a very sad, sad way in David's life. But Psalm 3, as you know, a couple decades after all that happened, and now we have Absalom raising up against David and turning a lot of the people against David to choose him as king. They'd had David king for a few decades, and he was probably saying, let's make Israel great again. Something like that. Sorry, I couldn't resist. That's not in my notes. But David's fleeing from Absalom occurs in 2 Samuel chapters 15 and 16. Now, in summary, while David was the king, his son Absalom became popular with the people, and he raised a rebellion in the town of Hebron, which is about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. The revolt happened suddenly, and as a result, David fled Jerusalem at night with those leaders that were faithful to him. Not all of the people that were faithful to David stayed faithful. Some of them followed Absalom. And so David descended from Jerusalem, crossed the Kidron Valley, went up the Mount of Olives to the safety of the desert. And we read in 2 Samuel that in his retreat, he went weeping and barefoot. In other words, he left in a hurry. His head was covered in sorrow. I mean, here was his son trying to overthrow him. It's one thing to have someone you knew and expected to be an enemy. If Absalom would have been a son of Saul, he would have said, well, that makes total sense. But this enemy came from within his own immediate family. And Absalom garnered others whom David trusted to line up with his revolt, lined up with Absalom's revolt. And some of David's counselors and some of his generals deserted him. Along the way, if we turn to 2 Samuel 16, we'll get to this in more detail later, but it just kind of sets the base for Psalm 3. 2 Samuel 16, verses 1 to 8. Now when David had passed a little beyond the summit, behold, Ziba, a servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them were 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, and 100 summer fruits, and a jug of wine. And the king said to Ziba, what do you have with these? And Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride, and bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and wine for whoever is faint in the wilderness to drink. And the king said, where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, behold, he is staying in Jerusalem. For he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. So the king said to Ziba, behold, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, I prostrate myself. Let me find favor in your sight, O Lord my king. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, son of Gera, who came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at David and all the servants of the king, and all the people and the mighty men were at his right hand and his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. So David was fleeing, and this guy comes out and cursed David and threw stones at him. I mean, it's a low point. It's a low point. That's the backdrop of Psalm 3. So he starts off with Psalm 3 and he says, many are my foes and many are rising up against me. Yeah, that's what he's talking about. You'll also notice in this psalm, the opponents of David are mentioned in verse 1 and verse 2 and verse 6. How many are my foes? Many of our saying of my soul that there's no salvation in God. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people. And the word Selah occurs after verses 1, 2, and 8. And as we've said before, this is most likely a musical note that means to stop and rest. It only occurs in poetry. It's the only place you find it. Some take it to mean that we should stop and think about what was just stated, to reflect on it, and that's fine. But I'm not sure that's what that meant. The first stanza, verses 1 and 2, tell of what has just taken place. Enemies have risen up against him. Matthew Henry said this, Absalom's faction, like a snowball, strangely gathered in its motion. David speaks of it as one amazed, and well he might, that a people he had so many ways obliged should almost generally revolt from him, to rebel against him and choose for their head such a silly, giddy young fellow Absalom was. How slippery and deceitful are the many, and how little fidelity and constancy is to be found among men. David had the hearts of his subjects as much as any king ever had, but now, of a sudden, he had lost all of them. The foes of Christianity are everywhere, and this will continue until God puts a stop to it. If you were there at the in the Wednesday night study on Revelation, you know, the foes of Christian are everywhere, and they're going to end up being very, very, very strong, but God's going to put an end to it. And David had lots of enemies. And remember, he was a very popular king. He had songs that were sung about him. But Absalom had turned away many against him, and his popularity had sunk. 2 Samuel 15:16 says that Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. And 2 Samuel 15:12 says that conspiracy of Absalom was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So he was working this, and he was getting a lot of popular public support. Now, we need to make sure that we never think that because we have numbers on our side that it validates the position of that group. I mean, there's lots of people with numbers on that side. In fact, it probably just shows the opposite. If I was going to go to a big city and move there and find a church, I probably would say, oh, this church has 5, 10,000 people. Probably not the place that's preaching the gospel. There are a few exceptions, but they're minor. You know, Joel Osteen's church has, what, 40,000? He hasn't preached the gospel for probably forever. So numbers do not indicate correctness or truth or rightness. And a good example of this also is the crowds at the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. The numbers said crucify him, but the numbers were wrong. So at the end of the first stanza, David laments that his enemies are saying that God was no longer interested in helping to deliver him, or that God had left him. Now you remember, this is exactly what happened to Saul. Because Saul rejected God, didn't turn to God in repentance of any kind, and Saul left him. Samuel told Saul that God was leaving him. And they're accusing David of the same thing. Verse 2, many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. So that's what they were saying. God has left him. Just like Saul, probably. I would think they'd say, well, yeah, look what happened to Saul. That's happening to David. We need Absalom because Absalom's got this new great platform. Absalom did not have the anointing of God. So it was a low blow to David. Now the second stanza, though, after this low blow and all everything that's sitting there, David expresses his confidence in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. Remember, he had left Jerusalem weeping, barefoot, distressed. But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. It's very easy to focus our attention on the enemy that's around us and the challenges we face. Oh, I got all this stuff I've got to worry about. But we must focus on the provision that God has promised to us, and that he would be true to his word and to his promises. A shield about me, he says, you, O Lord, are a shield about me. It means the protection that surrounds a man entirely. It's not like just a shield a soldier would carry that, you know, covers a little bit, but it's a complete shield. It's a shield above, beneath, around, without, and within. It's a total shield. I guess you could think of it like some of these new boats that, you know, the race boats that they put the drivers in, and they're protected on all sides. So when that boat crashes, and they usually do, you know, he's protected. And that's the shield. It's total and it's complete. And that's the shield that God is for his people. And that's the shield God is for us. And then David says, God is my glory. Though he was driven from his capital in contempt and in scorn, he looks to return in triumph, because God is my glory and God is the lifter of my head. He does say, I've got the strength, and I'm going to go get an army, and we're going to come and get it done. No, God is my glory. God will lift my head. And remember, he had just had his head down, but now he realizes God's going to lift my head up. Again, I'm reminded of the philosophy of our world today. You can do it. There's nothing you can't do if you don't put your mind to it. I mean, we hear that continually. You are the master of your own destiny. I was thinking about this, and I went out, and I just looked at some books on this subject that sell millions of copies. Here's the titles of these books. Visualize and Achieve. You Can If You Think You Can. You might have heard of this one. Think and Grow Rich. I've been thinking on that, but it hadn't happened yet. Spontaneous Healing. And The Magic of Believing. And these books sell thousands and thousands and thousands of copies. But David has it right. Thou, O Lord, are a shield about me. You're my glory, and you're the lifter of my head. And sometimes the enemies and the hardships can appear overwhelming. I don't know what you guys face, but sometimes we have hardships and we have discouragements, and it can be overwhelming. And Spurgeon wrote this, it is the most bitter of all afflictions to be led to fear that there is no help for us in God. If there is no help for us in God, that's the most bitter of affliction. And that's what they were telling David. There is no help for him in God. But David said, oh, yes, there is. That is our help. Our help comes from God. If we ever get to the point that there's no hope, that God can't help, that he can do nothing, not even a little, that would lead, I would think, to complete despair. And if, as I read and listen to what people say today, they express a faith in faith or a hope in hope. Now, we've all heard people say, and probably this week, if you go out and look, my thoughts and prayers are with you. And these aren't believers. My thoughts and prayers are with you. Sometimes they admonish others to keep them in their thoughts and prayers, and they're not believers. Well, what does that actually mean? They're nice thoughts, but they come from one who absolutely has no clue on where the source of comfort and help comes from. A Christian, we can say, I'm going to pray for you that God will do his work, and he will deliver, and he will lift your head up. Yes?
Yeah, I think it's Proverbs 18 that says that the name of the Lord is a strong tower, and the righteous run to it and are safe.
That's a great verse.
That's so good.
That was Proverbs what?
18:10.
Proverbs 18:10. I repeated it so people could look at it if they're listening to this. So the message of this psalm focuses on the delivery that God provides, not the enemy that's surrounding him. The gospel message will always have enemies. Both those who are not believers and sometimes from people who would claim to be believers. Our confidence must not be in men, because men will disappoint. Our confidence needs to be in God. God will never disappoint. A good scriptural example of this is found in Numbers 13. Remember when Moses sent 12 people to the promised land to spy and report back to what they had seen and observed. 10 of them came back and said, we can't go in there. Those enemies are too strong. 2 of them said, God will deliver us and God will provide. And we know what happened. They said, well, we're going to go with the 10. And what happened? 40 years of wandering. Everybody that was 20 years or older of Israel died before they got into the promised land, with the exception of the two spies that told the truth. And David is showing in this psalm that his focus is in the right direction. It's toward God. We do not need to fear a world that is the enemy of and bent against Christianity. When we have a God who hears our prayers, who has promised to set up his eternal kingdom of peace and righteousness. In verse 4, David begins to cry out to God. He lifts up his voice, not just his thoughts. He says, I cried aloud to the Lord. It's okay to do that. Sometimes we don't. You know, it's okay to cry to the Lord. There is embedded in this stanza in verse 4 a wonderful truth. God hears. This is something that's incredibly comforting. We do not have a God who makes us go it alone. He hears. And not only he hears, he cares for his own. Turn to Matthew 7, if you would. Matthew 7. Starting with verse 11. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? Therefore, however, you want people to treat you, so treat them, for this is the law and the prophets. Excuse me, I started with 11. I started 7. Ask and it shall be given you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. And he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks it shall be opened. Or what man is there among you, when his son shall ask him for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he shall ask for a fish, he will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him. Jesus talks about asking God for help and care. And underneath all of this is the understanding is that God hears. And then the third stanza. He starts out in verse 5. He says, I laid down and I slept. He was able to lie down and sleep in the midst of the danger he was facing. This is a picture of trusting in God, that God would protect him, that God would sustain him and deal accordingly with his enemies. And he wakes and he's rested because of his confidence in God, because the Lord sustained him. After this night of rest and confidence in God, he can say that he can face, with God on his side, 10,000 of people or thousands of people who have set themselves against him from all sides. I woke again and the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. We will also see that, you know, with God, it doesn't matter the size or the strength of the enemy. We don't need to fear. Remember, it is God who is all-powerful. The word Elohim is the all-powerful one, the name of God. We need to understand that simple line, and we've probably all heard it, with God we have a majority, because God is the majority. This is reminiscent of an event where Martin Luther was on his way to Worms, where he had been called by the emperor and the papal legate to answer for his teachings, when the Catholic branded him as a heretic. He was promised safe conduct, but so had John Huss been promised safe conduct, and he was captured and burned at the stake. Luther was warned not to go, but he said to another warning just before entering the city, quote, even if there I should be as many devils in Worms as tiles upon the housetops, still I would enter it. Kind of very similar to David's statement. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people or thousands of people who have set themselves against me. Years later, Luther recalled that event saying, quote, I was then undaunted. I feared nothing. And we know that he didn't back down from his teaching, because it was in Worms that he made his classic reply to the Diet there, quote, unless I be persuaded by the words of Scripture and sound reasoning, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I can do no other. God help me. Amen. Very similar. I mean, he was applying Psalm chapter 3. Note that David displayed a trust in God in dire times. It's easier to trust in God in good times. In 1862, a guy named Philip Power wrote this. To trust only when appearances are favorable is to sail only with the wind and the tide, to believe only when we can see. Oh, let us follow the example of the psalmist and seek that unreservedness of faith which will enable us to trust God, come what will, and to say, as he said, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. Then we have the fourth stanza, verses 7 and 8. In this last section, David shows a confidence and deliverance from God again. Verse 7 mentions that God strikes his enemies on the cheek and shattered the teeth of the wicked. It says, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek, you break the teeth of the wicked. Now, this is an expression that's taken from a comparison of the enemies to a wild beast. The cheekbone is the bone that holds the teeth. And to break that, you've disarmed the animal. And so he's saying, you're going to strike my enemies on the cheek and break the teeth of the wicked. You are going to dismantle my enemies. And God, you're going to do it. And we'll find out that God did do that to Absalom and his followers. In verse 7, the words are very similar to Numbers chapter 10, verse 35. Let's turn there for a second. Numbers 10, 35. I'm not keeping up with my slides very well. Numbers 10:35, and says, then it came about when the ark sent out that Moses said, rise up, O Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let those who hate thee flee before thee. Pretty similar to what David is saying here. For you strike all my enemies on the cheek and break the teeth of the wicked. Before they said, arise, O God, and save me, O God. This saying showed the confidence that God would lead them when Moses said that in number 7. In a sense, it was a war cry when Moses said, rise up, O Lord. It carried the history and the meaning when it was used. Rise up, O Lord. And David was aware that when he was saying those words, it showed, it was kind of a war cry and showed confidence that God was leading. And later we're going to find out that over 20,000 of Absalom's troops were killed, including Absalom. So it was not just 5 or 6 people. It was a good chunk. And the last verse speaks to the deliverance and salvation from God, followed by his blessing. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Everything is from God. And David in this particular case, and each of us in any other case, cannot gain victory without the intervention needed from God. Our salvation is entirely his doing. And in our Christian walk, any victory we have is entirely due to him. And then the interesting thing about salvation, God gives it to us. All our victories are from him. And then he blesses us for letting him gain the victory. That's pretty incredible. Now, when we introduced the Psalms a few weeks ago, I said many of them are set to music. This is one that's set to music. I don't know if you know that. But it's kind of a Jewish sounding song. But I want you to open Psalm 3 and listen to it. This is a chorus called, "Thou art a shield for me." And you can see, now when they sing this song, you can think about what David was thinking, everything that was going through, and now the words are set in the right context and they might make more sense. So, if I got this right, here's how it goes.
Thou art they priests that trouble me, many are they that rise up against me, many are they that say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and lifter of my head. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and lifter of my head. I will not be afraid of 10,000 of people who set themselves against me round about. Be afraid of 10,000 of people who set themselves against me round about. For thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter of my head. For thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. I lay me down and I slept. I wait for the Lord. Sustain me, sustain me. Now are they priests that trouble me, many are they that rise up against me, many are they that say of my soul, there is no help for me.
I listen to that song and I read that and go, oh, that it fits, you know. Thou, O Lord, art a shield for me. So next time you read Psalm 3, you might think a few more things as you read it. You hear that song.
Who are the singers?
Kent Henry, it's a praise worship thing that came out a long time ago. It goes in, that song goes right into Let God Arise, you know.
Can but, you put the information on that out on your notes?
Yeah, I can do that. It's probably about a 20-year-old CD or something like that. Yeah.
Thank you for finding that.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
We'll have to sing that maybe in Sunday. Yeah, sing the scripture, things are going to be right. Okay, now let's go back to 1 Samuel 20. We have a few minutes here to get a little ways. We just finished in 1 Samuel 19. The Saul coming to find, to get David at Ramah, and God basically put a stop to it and said, no, you're not. And that allowed David time to flee from David, from Naoth to Ramah. Let's read the first few verses of Saul, 1 Samuel 20. Then David fled from Naoth to Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? So David was, what's going on? What have I done? Obviously the answer is nothing. Verse 2, and he said to him, far from it, you shall not die. Behold my father, this is Jonathan speaking, behold my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? Is it not so? So Jonathan is saying, I don't really know what's going on here. Now maybe he did, maybe he didn't. We don't know. Yet David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. So David said to Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down and eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. If he says, it is good, your servant shall be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. So this is the plan that they put together. The plan was agreed upon where Jonathan would determine the latest attitude of his father, Saul, and let David know. So if David was missing from the king's table, and Saul got upset, well, we got a problem. He said, that's fine, no problem. To begin with, this is a horrible plan, because it's based on deceit. It's based on lies. David asked Jonathan to lie. I had to go home. Jonathan knows you didn't go home. You're just avoiding it. So Jonathan, and we're going to find out later in verse 29, that Jonathan lied to Saul and repeated the lie that David had suggested. The result of the question, if we go through and read this whole thing, is that Saul was very angry. It says in verse 34, he was fiercely angered. And he said, David must die. And when Jonathan asked him why, you know that spear that Saul was trying to kill David with? He threw it at his son Jonathan. I don't think I'd have liked to have Saul as a father. But if you read through this whole thing, kept on going, that's what they did. Start at verse 19. It says, when you have stayed out for 3 days, you shall quickly come to the place where you hid yourself in that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone easel. And this is Jonathan saying, I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And I will send the lad saying, go find the arrows. If I specifically say to the lad, now David's hiding so he can hear all this, behold, the arrows are on this side of you, get them, then come, for it's safe. No harm will come to you. But if I say to the youth, behold, the arrows are beyond you, go, for the Lord has sent you away. As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. So David hid in the field. When the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. And the king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, it is an accident, he is not clean, but surely he is not clean. And it came about the next day, and the second day of the new moon, David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal, either yesterday or today? And this is where Jonathan repeated the lie that they had planned. David said, earnestly ask leave of me to go to Bethlehem. And verse 30, then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. How come he brought the mother into the thing? It's not my fault. When anybody has an argument like that, you know they don't have a whole lot of legs to stand on, right? Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. But he didn't know that Jonathan didn't care about that anyway. Jonathan wasn't there to be king, and Jonathan understood that David was going to be the next king and was fine with that. Now therefore send and bring him to me, for he must die. And then Jonathan said, well, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Well, Saul just basically said he's going to be king instead of you. So that's really what Saul was all about there. Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down, so that Jonathan knew his father had decided to put David to death. Yeah, he kind of played his cards there. Then Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. And then later in verse 35 to verse 42, they go out, he shoots the arrow, tells the lad, you know, basically tells David, it's not safe to come. And Jonathan, in verse 41, it says, when the lad was gone, David arose from the south side and fell on his face on the ground and bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. And Jonathan said to David, go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever. Then he rose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. So that is the covenant or the promise that David and Jonathan made after Jonathan was sure that Saul's only purpose was to kill David. And we're going to see later, in fact, if we go back to Psalm 3, the word Mephibosheth came in there. Well, that was Jonathan's son, who caused some problems later on that David preserved because of his covenant with Jonathan. That gets us through chapter 21. Next week we will go, chapter 20. Next week we'll start on 1 Samuel 21. And probably go through 1 Samuel 21 and a lot of 1 Samuel 22 as this rivalry, not rivalry is the wrong word, but as this attempt of Saul to kill David heats up. And we're going to see in the middle of Psalm 2 Samuel 22 that Saul will kill many people because they helped David. So like I say, the Lord had left him and he had given himself over to every sorts of debauchery that he could do. But David said, thou, O Lord, art a shield. And I like the thought of the shield completely surrounding. There's no Achilles heel in that shield. It's complete. Let's bow for prayer.